Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. You'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalog of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we will be talking to one Catherine Nelson, the General Manager of Franklin Covey, Australia and New Zealand. A little bit of a different episode for you today, but I am so excited about this opportunity to learn from Catherine about strategies that I feel we can all implement in our lives to look after ourselves better and ultimately, therefore, become more efficient at what we do, help more clients, and consequently, the end stakeholders, help more animals. So let's dive in. As the General Manager of Franklin Covey in Australia and New Zealand, Catherine is passionate about helping individuals and organisations create great cultures by building leadership at every level. Prior to this role, Catherine served as the Global Vice President of Leadership Development at Franklin Covey, where she led teams that developed several of Franklin Covey's award-winning and best-selling training solutions, including the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People 4.0 and the 4 Essential Roles of Leadership. She has also served as a subject matter expert on unconscious bias, understanding bias to unleash potential, and the 7 Habits for Managers. In addition to her work shaping leadership strategy, she was previously the managing consultant for Franklin Covey's customer loyalty practice, focused on developing organizational cultures, delighting customers, and winning employee loyalty. Her thought leadership was critical to the development of Franklin Covey's customer and employee engagement methodologies. Catherine has a master's degree in organizational behavior and completed undergraduate studies in education and psychology. She worked for more than 20 years internationally, helping organizations around the globe be more effective before returning to Australia to lead the local Franklin Covey team there. So without further ado, it's our very great pleasure to welcome Catherine Nelson to the show today, patiently waiting by in Adelaide, Australia. Catherine, thank you so much for making time to come and hang out with us animal trainers.
Oh, Ryan, what a delight. What a special way to start my day here. This is lovely.
Yeah, fantastic. And to get started, Catherine, I was wondering if, obviously we mentioned your numerous roles in your bio there, but can you just share with everyone a little bit more this unaware animal training community, a little bit more about Franklin Covey? What is Franklin Covey and what is it that you and your organization do?
Well, Ryan, so Franklin Covey is a global leadership and development organization. It started a little over 30 years ago by a man named Stephen Covey, who wrote the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. It was a global phenomenon. It still is the biggest personal leadership book of all time. And over the last 30 years, it's really spawned many other great content and thought leadership around personal effectiveness, personal leadership, team leadership, organizational leadership. And then, as you mentioned in my bio, other things around employee engagement, customer loyalty, unconscious bias. It's really trying to do, you know, how are we more effective as human beings? And then how do we bring that into the organizations that we're in? Because most problems in organizations tend to be people problems. There are certainly system problems and other problems for sure, but at the end of the day, you'll see that most problems either have some element or come down to the core of people really struggling either to lead themselves well or to work well with other people. And so there's lots and lots of connections, I think, to the work that you're doing and that your listeners are doing. When you think about improving behavior, whether it's in the animal kingdom or in the human kingdom, there's lots of different things that I think that we do to help people really achieve personal effectiveness and then interpersonal effectiveness as well.
That's pretty impressive that it's the biggest, tell me if I've got this right, the biggest personal leadership best-selling, is that correct? Personal leadership
book of all time? So it's the biggest seller. I can't say it. It's the biggest selling personal leadership book of all time. It's sold over 40 million copies that we know of. There are plenty. I remember one time one of my colleagues was traveling in a country that shall not be named and saw the Seven Habits book, and it was a complete knockoff. It had a picture of Yul Brynner on the back instead of Stephen Covey. I don't know if you remember, Yul Brynner was a bald guy. Stephen Covey was a bald guy. They just found a picture of a bald guy and stuck it on the back. But there are about 40 million copies that have officially been sold. And it's the sort of book, sells about 10,000 copies a week without us doing any advertising, which is remarkable. For a book to be a bestseller, it needs to sell 250,000 copies, which in the book world is a lot of books. So you could imagine that 40 million is really sensational. There's probably only about, I don't know, maybe 50 books that have sold as many as that. And I'd be surprised if there were 50, that has sold that many books.
It's hard to even fathom how influential that is, especially when you consider the ripoffs that are doing their rounds as well. Did you meet Stephen?
I did. Yes, I did. In fact, I worked with him on a couple of projects. He was a remarkable man. In fact, the thing that I like to say about Stephen was that he was the real deal. Do you know sometimes when you meet a famous person and there's a public persona and there's a private persona that's quite different? And it's like, oh, I thought you would be. Well, Stephen was what you saw in public was also what you saw in private. He was an authentic human being, very principled, but lots of fun. He had a great sense of humor. He loved being with his family. And Stephen was the sort of person that he was just genuinely interested in the person that he was with. So when you were with Stephen, he was with you and really made you feel like you were the only person in the room at the time and that you were the most important person worth listening to. So he was a remarkable person like that, just really had a gift in terms of the way that he worked with other people.
And do you feel like that authenticity just came through in his book and that led to 40 million sales? Is that a component of why this?
Boy, what an interest. So, you know, you have to ask, why did the book become such a global phenomenon when it did? I think it was a couple of things. First thing, what I love about the story was Stephen was 57 years old when the book was published. And he had about a 30-year career as an effective university professor, business consultant, and he was at a time in his life when I think many people are counting down the days to their retirement. And Stephen felt like he had more to give. And that was when he actually left the university and formed what he called Covey Leadership Center. And from there, the goal was just to do some consulting, I think. He wanted to spend the rest of his years consulting. And somebody advised him, Stephen, you need to write a book. At the time, some of his other colleagues were really concerned that if he wrote a book, it would cannibalize the consulting work that he did. But he went ahead and wrote it. And I think many times it was, you know, many people can feel like they're washed up at a certain point of their life, but actually everything that Stephen had done up until that point had really prepared him. And he had spent his life studying what made people effective. I mean, it's such a profound question. He'd done his dissertation looking at kind of wisdom literature for the previous 200 years, and he'd noticed that something profound had changed. That in the, say, 200 years earlier, when people were writing about what made somebody successful, they talked a lot about ethics, they talked a lot about character, they talked a lot about who you are and that sort of authenticity. But he noticed that there was a shift that had occurred about 100 years earlier, where it started to be much more about this sort of public persona, and it was all about personality. It was about how you looked. And there was a shift. And I think Stephen wrote the book at a time, it was at the end of the 80s. And if anyone knows, or, you know, anyone's my age and can remember that time, the 80s were a time where people were feeling that we had kind of lost our way a little bit. You know, the 60s had been this big turmoil, and then the 70s were all sort of progress. But by the 80s, I think people were a little bit worn out. And Stephen's book was a panacea. It came at a time that said, all these things that seem so important are not important. And what's really important is getting back to some basic, powerful core principles that if you look at what people do that make them effective, they fit into these timeless principles of human effectiveness. And people would say, oh, well, they're common sense. And Stephen would say, yes, but common sense is not common practice. So I think it was a couple of things. I think Stephen was reaching a crescendo in his career of studying and really learning what mattered most. And it came at a time when people were just really ready to hear it. What's been so profound is the enduring nature of the message. And I think as we talk about some of these things today, Ryan, they will speak to people's souls just as they did back then.
Yeah, well, that's something that I was thinking as you're talking there. 30 years, it really has stood the test of time. Is 2021 the time that is ready for Stephen Covey's work as well? Like we talked about the 80s being ready for Covey's work. Yeah. Why has it stood the test of time? Has it changed? Has it shifted? Are you adding to it? Or is it still the same body of work that is as relevant now as it was in the 80s?
Look, it's such a great question. So we talk about two things. One is timeless principles, and the other is timely practices or just-in-time practices. So I'll give you an example. If you think about great leaders, and I've asked people around the world, I said, tell me about the very best leader that you've ever worked with. What was it about this leader that made them so remarkable? And I said, look, it can be anybody. It might be your current boss. It might be someone that was your youth leader when you were 15. It could be a mentor that you had early in your career. What was it about this leader that was so special? And people will invariably tell me about who that person was. That person had my back. They trusted me. They believed in me. They'll tell you that they effectively communicated what was most important. And when I write the list of what they tell me was the most profound thing about the best leader that they've ever had, do you know what they almost never say? They were the most technically competent person that I've ever worked with. Now, if you think about it, most leaders are promoted for their technical competence. But what distinguishes great leadership is really what we would call the softer side, the people side, the human side, their integrity, their trustworthiness, their ability to see the person for who they really are. And so those are the things that really distinguish effective people. And one that I mentioned earlier, people will say, this person was a really good communicator. And so when we teach leadership skills out to people, we teach leaders how to be effective communicators. Now, whether you were Napoleon or whether you are, you know, a leader today, you need to be able to communicate effectively. But what it looked like, so that's a timeless principle. It doesn't matter where in history or in what country of the world you're in, you need to be an effective communicator. However, what that practice looks like, Ryan, today, it's very different from the 1980s. It's very different from the 1750s. It's very different from 3000 BC, but it's still the same principle. So we talk about timeless principles and we talk about just-in-time practices. And we know that those two things, that's kind of how we take the seven habits out to people.
So explain to me again, the timeless principles is, okay, communication is effective. What's the just-in-time practices component?
So the just-in-time practices might be whether it's email or it's texting, right? So the actual medium that we're using for that today is very different than what it would have been even 30 years ago. I don't think Stephen Covey even wrote an email because he had an assistant and he'd never, you know, but But he understood the principle. So what we do today is we take those principles and we also put the timely practices in there. What does effective communication look like today? We know that there are timeless principles for inspiring trust in the people around us. It's about integrity. It's about motive and intent. It's about capability and results. Those things determine whether or not somebody can trust you. The tools that we have today are different, but the principles have not changed. And I think when you and your listeners really think about the timeless principles for working with animals, there are things that are absolutely timeless. The practices that we use today, the tools that we have, the information that we have is very timely, and we might adjust how we do those things, but those things haven't disappeared. They just look a little bit different today.
Interesting. And I want to share something with you and offer something for our listeners to tie some of their animal training links to this podcast episode and links in this podcast episode. Stephen talked about the emotional bank account. And
that's right.
We have something which has become popularized in our industry called the trust account, and it is taken from Stephen's work, and it's about making sure that we're putting lots of deposits in our animals' trust account, offering lots of reinforcers for them, so that when we need to make a withdrawal and take them to the vet, etc., we have enough in our account to make those withdrawals. So I don't know if you were aware of that, but.
I wasn't, but that's very much Stephen's work. So yeah, so he developed the, you know, well, what Stephen did was he took a lot of ideas and gave them very simple names that people could understand and incorporate. And he understood that trust is fragile. So you need to put a lot of deposits in. And one of the things that he says is that you cannot talk your way out of a situation that you have behaved your way into, right? So if you have behaved your way into a situation that you aren't being trusted, you can't talk your way out of it. You have to behave your way out of it. And I think, you know, as you're thinking about the emotional bank account or the trust account that you have, there are lots and lots of deposits that have to go in there. Because you're right, there are times when we do make a withdrawal, or you know what can feel like a withdrawal, and you have to have such a strong foundation that the trust isn't damaged by that. But if you do something that is significantly damaging, it can take a long time, and you can't just talk your way back into it. You know, as a human being, certainly as an animal carer, you would know you cannot just try and talk your way back into trust. Because that's just not even a language that you can communicate. And that's the same with human beings, which is really interesting. We need consistent behavior in order to be able to trust.
I love it. You cannot talk your way out of a situation that you have behaved your way into. We just, the day before recording this podcast episode, because it's going to be released into the future, I wrote a blog on our website, and I just realized as I'm talking to you, I put Stephen's name in there because I was talking about the trust account and I mentioned that it originally came from his work. Fun to tie this together. Hey, you said that this is maybe framed, this information, as the softer side. It's not, when you talk about technical skills versus, is that something you find challenging going into an organization to kind of come in with this quote, I'm doing air quote signs at the moment, the softer information?
Yes and no, sometimes for sure. And it depends what kind of organization that we're going into, right? And gosh, we do work all around the world. We have offices in 140 different countries, and our materials available in, you know, dozens of languages. So, but sometimes people call these the soft skills. And in my experience, they're sometimes the hardest ones to get right if you don't understand them. And I think that would be the same in the work that you guys do, because people could think that the approach that you're taking is, you know, air quotes again, soft. But what you know is it's actually getting it right can be hard, but when you get it right, it transforms everything. And so it's very easy to fall back on some strict technical things. And so, you know, let's look at, you know, the world of work that I live in every single day. People will tell you about their qualifications. And I'm not going to pick on any, you know, but, you know, an example might be, well, someone's got 3 degrees in accounting, or they've got, you know, IT qualifications, you know, as long as your arm. And so we tend to hire for that because those technical skills matter so much. And I'm not saying do not hire for technical skills. We all need the technical skills. Otherwise, we don't have any sort of, real prowess in the roles that we have. But what we know is that these so-called soft skills become incredible accelerants when you apply them. So, if I'm working with a doctor, let's just say that I go in to have, maybe I need to have something done on my knee. I need someone that is technically superb. I don't want someone that's trying this on me for the first time, right? So technical skills matter. And that's what I mean by technical. I mean the actual qualifications that you have earned in your area of expertise. But if you look at patient rankings of doctors and who they think are the best doctors, they almost invariably rank people on their bedside manner. Does the doctor listen to me? Does he or she have real empathy? Do they seem to see me as a person? People will tell you that this terrible doctor came in, gave them this awful news without any empathy, walked back out again, technically proficient and emotionally insufficient. So a lot of what we're teaching people is how, and particularly people that are very technically skilled, is how do you increase your emotional intelligence so that you have that as an accelerant to your technical skills. It's not a substitute for them. It's something that really brings them to life and allows you to be a lot better.
It's interesting. I'm glad we're having this conversation. I was sharing with you before we pushed record that early episodes we'd made on a subject about the growth mindset have been framed as some of people's favorite episodes that have listened to the ATA show. But I know like bringing the softer side into our conversation where we are people that practice observing behavior and just getting good at describing behavior. And the question that comes to our community's mind when they say growth mindset is, what does that look like? Before you said common sense is not common practice, how important is it for you, or not important, to teach kind of the practice? And I think you said this about Stephen. Stephen was about doing, about what things we can do. Like, how important is it in your guys' teaching to teach behaviors that people can implement to pair with the softer sciences, or not softer skills, I should say?
Yeah, so I love how you brought up growth mindset. I love Carol Dweck's work. She is she's a pioneer in this field. And she's quoted all around the world for this incredible insight that people who have a mindset of continual growth and learning. In fact, there's another woman named, I think it's Carolee Adams, sorry, Merrily Adams. And she talks about the difference between a learner mindset and a judger mindset. So, and it's the same kind of idea. You've got the learner, you've got the person that has an open mind that says, okay, what's really going on here in this situation? I can kind of put my ego out of it for a second. What am I doing? What's this animal doing? What's this human doing? Like, what's really going on here? It's a mindset of asking questions. The judger mindset, the fixed mindset, is one of deciding very quickly with answers and, oh, this is a bad person, this is a bad dog, this is, this is a child that's never going to go anywhere. That is a judgment that shuts off all growth and all learning. And Stephen identified this. He believed that the greatest way to change a behavior was to change a mindset. So a lot of what we do is, way before we teach people any effective behaviors, we come back in and we start with mindsets. What do you really believe about this situation? And what do highly effective leaders believe? Because here's what we know. The best leaders have very different mindsets from mediocre leaders. And if you think about people in your expertise, they have a very different mindset about animals than maybe a mediocre person working with animals does. And I'm not trying to call anybody a bad person, but there's a very big difference between a growth mindset and a fixed mindset, between a learner mindset and a judger mindset. And so what we try and do is we start with, what do I believe about this situation that's preventing me from growing? What do I believe about this person? What do I believe about this animal? What do I believe about this situation that has become fixed or judgmental and I can now no longer learn? And one of the habits, and you know, we'll talk about what they are, but one of the habits, habit five, is called seek first to understand, then to be understood. And it's highly effective people learn before they do. They ask good questions. They stay in the moment. Tell me about what you believe about the situation. Tell me what you think is going on. Hey, I have a concern. I noticed this thing happened. Tell me from your experience what that was all about. It's a slowing down before you speed up. And what it does is it gives you a moment to learn something. And when you learn something, then you can do something. But unfortunately, many of us just move in really quickly with this judgment. Oh, that's what's going on there. That's what's going on there. You go here, you go there. This animal's that, that person's that. And when you come in with a fixed, closed mindset like that, you can't learn anything and you can't change behavior. You can only put people into boxes and put animals into categories. And then it's efficient, it's very fast. But Stephen's gift, I believe, was he defined the difference between efficient and effective. So efficient, you know, it's not the seven habits of highly efficient people. It's the seven habits of highly effective people. And what he learned was that there were seven sets of behaviors that people who got what they wanted out of life, who had great relationships, who had meaningful contributions, actually did seven core behaviors differently than the norm. And they did them habitually. And the great thing is that they can be learned and anyone can get better at them.
Well, I have so many questions, but I realize we probably need to get to actually talking about what the seven habits are. Before we do, though, can you just share with everyone listening, because I know people listen to podcasts while they're driving around, et cetera, and they kind of listen to segments here, segments here. If someone wanted to find out more at this point in their listening journey of this episode, where can they go online to find you guys?
Yeah, so you can just Google the seven habits of highly effective people. That'll probably bring up the book. But if you want to know more about and get some free downloads and things that we do, go to franklincovey.com and you can go to franklincovey.com.au, franklincovey.co.nz, franklincovey.co.uk, franklincovey.com. It just depends where you are in the world. The websites have a lot of very similar information. But just go to the one that's closest to you. But just Google Franklin Covey and you will find, a lot of great information about the things that we've talked about today.
Yeah, awesome. And there's learning opportunities. We connected earlier with someone else on your team. There's learning opportunities for individuals at home as well, isn't there? It's not just for organisations.
Yeah, so primarily, you know, we're a corporation and we work, you know, we're in the business to do business. So we do a lot of work through corporations, but we have many people who individually attend our public programs. So if somebody really wanted to go through the seven habits training, they could. So you could go to our website. We also have a free mission statement builder on our website. It's, I think, the most popular thing on our website. And you can go there and build out your own mission statement. So go to the franklincovey.com website if you're interested in the mission statement builder, and we can talk a little bit more about what that is in a minute.
Yeah, wonderful. And we'll link to all of us in the show notes as well. And there's a podcast I've learned today and blog, so plenty to get involved in. Thanks so much for sharing everything so far, Catherine. It's been fun learning a little bit about the history and the effectiveness of the of the content. Moving forward, I've been excitingly telling everyone about the fact that I was going to be recording this episode today. And when I mentioned to our animal training community the name Covey, there was a look on people's faces like they're trying to scan their brains for recognition. And then I mentioned the seven habits of highly effective people, and you can see light bulbs have been going off everywhere. Everyone's heard of that somewhere along their journey. So I'm pumped that you're going to walk us through them today. And I've requested we're going to do a bit of a laser focus potentially on some of them that I've talked about often in our community and that have really changed my life. So let's dive in. Can you please talk us through the seven habits? What are they?
Okay. So let's start big picture and then we'll kind of go into some of them in detail. So again, what they are, it's a framework for thinking about effectiveness. And again, it's if you think about effectiveness, how do I get out of my life the things that I want to get out of my life? There are plenty of people that, you know, might be partway through their lives and feel like, I am just busting my gut, climbing a ladder, but I think it might be leaning up against the wrong wall. So the seven habits of highly effective people are the behaviors that effective people do consistently to achieve what matters most to them. And it's what matters most personally, what matters most professionally, what matters most socially. It's getting out of life the things that are most important to you. What we know is that highly effective people are intentional people. They don't leave the most important things to chance. And so these habits are what they do consistently to get out of their life what's most important to them. So that's a little bit of background. So let me start. So you have to start with this foundational principle before we start. So principles are timeless and universal. These habits are tied to timeless principles. And the fastest way to change behavior is to change a paradigm, a belief. So every habit has a belief system that goes along with it and then behaviors that you do. So the first habit one, is called be proactive. And I think for many of us, we think about proactivity as being taking initiative. And it's part of it, but habit one is absolutely foundational. And in fact, the seven habits are sequential. You can't practice habit seven or habit three if you don't have habit one under your belt. Habit one actually is a habit of choice. And ineffective people believe that they're a victim, that it's not their fault, that life is happening to them. But when I'm being effective as a human being, I am 100% responsible for myself, my moods, my choices. Habit one is the habit of choice. It says, I get to control what I think, what I do, who I associate with. Even if the world feels like it's all stacked up against me, I have a choice. I may not be able to choose what happens to me, but I absolutely get to choose my response to what happens to me. Habit one is foundational. It's extremely important because if you can't accept your own personal choice in any situation, even if you have a terrible spouse, you have no money, you have a job where you've just been fired, you have to find that space that says, what choices do I have right now? Rather than, I'm completely sunk, I don't have any choices, there's nothing I can do. Highly effective people have often dug themselves out of some terrible circumstances by focusing on what they can do, not on what they can't do. So that's habit one, be proactive. I get to choose my response in any set of circumstances. That leads, once you understand that belief, then that leads to habit two. And the second habit's called begin with the end in mind. And what it means is that highly effective people create goals. Habit two is the habit of vision. And what it says is that here's where I am today and here's where I want to be tomorrow. Whether I am 15 or I'm 85, I am someone that creates meaning and purpose for my life. So you'll look at people who are highly effective. They actually have an outcome that they're going towards. And what's interesting is that highly effective people bring this habit of vision into every single thing that they do. So Ryan, you and I doing this podcast today, you know, we start with what's our goal? By the end of this podcast, what do we want people to know, feel, and do? So it's the habit of vision in any meeting, in any training session with an animal. At the end of this session, what do I want this dog to do differently than when we started? So it's the habit of visioning, and it becomes really, really powerful because you get to choose if you're going to go to college or university, if you're going to change jobs, if you want to buy a home. An example of this, there's someone that I know who has been trying for a couple of years to save for a house. This person's young and they like to go out and have lots of fun. And we've talked about what it's going to take to, you know, to save a deposit. And every 6 months as we talk about it, this person still has not saved any more money towards buying a house. And when you begin with the end in mind and you go back to habit one and say, I get to make choices. I get to choose where I spend my money because my vision is I want to have a deposit for a home. Effective people not only set the goal, they actually do the steps to get to the goal. And that takes us to habit number three, which is to put first things first. Highly effective people, the principle here is execution. It's the habit of getting the most important things done because there's a big difference between what's urgent and what's important. and highly effective people can delay gratification, maybe not go out with their friends all weekend and spend all their money, but they will save. And they'll say, you know what, I'm not going to go out on Friday night, and I'm going to actually only go out twice this month because I've got to save this deposit for this house. You give up something that you want for something that you want more. That's the habit of execution. And it works, you know, some simple practices on this that Stephen pioneered. One is weekly planning. So, and it's something I've done for 20 years. At the beginning of every week, I sit down and I work out what are the most important things that I need to get done this week, not just this day. If you only focus on today, you're myopic. You can only see what's right in front of you. Weekly planning allows you to see a whole week and to put into place things that are important. Time with family, some personal goals, some learning, you know, so that you're not just reacting to all the urgencies and emergencies and dramas and last minute whims. So habit number three, put first things first, is the habit of every day making better choices so that you delay gratification and, you know, actually get what matters most to you. It doesn't mean that you have to live a boring monastic life because you've put everything to the side. It just says, gosh, if we want to get a deposit for this house, this is what we're going to have to eat rice and beans two nights a week. And you actually make that fun. So those are the first three habits: being proactive, beginning with the end in mind, and putting first things first. And what that does, when I consistently do those three things, I win what's called the private victory. I can lead and govern myself. And you can trust me because you know if I say, look, I'll get that done for you by Thursday, I will actually assume responsibility and I will make a plan and I'll get it done. So those are the first three habits. The next three habits are all about how we work with other people. And I can't work well with others if I can't lead and manage myself. So that's why habits 1, 2, and 3 are self-focused. Habits 4, 5, and 6 are people-focused. And so habit 4 is think win-win. It's not called get win-win. It's called think win-win. It's a mindset. It's a growth mindset. It's an abundance mindset. It means that I go into any circumstance and I treat you with respect and I treat myself with respect. I think, what's the win in this for Ryan and what's the win in this for me? How do I treat Ryan respectfully and also act in a way because I am worthy of being respected? It's the habit of mutual benefit. Highly effective people treat others well and they treat themselves well. The opposite of that is to think win-lose, I compete with you all the time, or to think lose-win, I'm a doormat, walk all over me, everybody else does. Highly effective people have a healthy self-esteem and they treat other people with respect. Habit 5 is called seek first to understand, then to be understood. It's the habit of influence. It's the habit of listening. And, you know, many of us, and this is the hardest one for me, I've been doing this for more than 20 years and I'm still like, dang, I didn't listen well enough in those circumstances. Habit 5 is all about letting the other person share their point of view first. Because as we mentioned earlier, you'll learn something. You will come to see things differently. You will be influenced. And that's when I say, well, Ryan, tell me what's really important to you in this situation. And you share with me what's important to you. And I think about that. I say, well, I hadn't considered it like that. Well, can I share what's important to me in this situation, Ryan? So, all right, okay, so if we're both trying to get mutual benefit here, how do we create a win-win that we both feel really good about? So habit 5 are people who are really good listeners, but they also are good advocates. They're not doormats, remember? They are good advocates for themselves, but they really consider the other person's point of view as well. Habit 6 is called synergize, and it's the habit of innovation. It's where you and I might have two very different ideas on something, but we value our differences and we listen well and we brainstorm and we come up with something better than you and I could have come up with alone. So highly effective people are not threatened by others. They don't minimize other people's accomplishments. They actually build on them. They think big and they create with others way better outcomes than they could have done alone. There's no ego involved. They're excited for somebody else's success. It is a very mature person at habit 6 that can consistently build on, you know, the goodness of other people and the differences of others. So once I can live habits 4, 5, and 6, I think win-win, I listen first and I create synergy and innovation with other people. I win what's called the public victory. I am a great person to work with. People like to work with me. The last habit is called habit 7, sharpen the saw. And it comes from an analogy of, you know, a guy out in the woods trying to saw through a log and going back and forth, and the saw gets stuck. And somebody says to him, you know, you need to stop and sharpen that saw. He says, I don't have time. And it's the idea that if we don't stop and sharpen our own saw as human beings, we will get burnt out. And this is another habit that really resonates with people. We can just go, it's like driving along and trying to speed home because you're running out of petrol or you're running out of gas. You're going to get to a point where you will run out if you don't continuously feed yourself physically, mentally, spiritually, and emotionally. And so, you know, by spiritually, you know, we know now that people who meditate even a minute a day have better health outcomes than people who don't. Their blood pressure's lower, they're at lower risk of heart disease. So there are enormous physical, social, and emotional benefits to taking time every day. Do you go for a walk? Get some exercise? Do you eat well? Do you get enough sleep? Do you read? Do you learn? Do you meditate? People who have a consistent practice in their life of doing this don't get burnt out. And burnout is the biggest, it's the biggest problem in terms of being ineffective, because think about when you don't listen well. Think about when you become reactive. It's because you're just burnt out. You've got nothing left. Somebody says, can I talk to you about something? You think, no, I don't have any space for another conversation. And it's because we're not taking time to fill ourselves up every single day. And that's the important part of habit 7. You need to fill your own well. You need to put your own mask on before you can put the mask on to others. And highly effective people do that habitually. It's not selfish. It's not thoughtless. It's actually an act of self-care that produces incredible results for the people around you as well.
Yeah, and I burnt out last year. I label what I burnt out last year once we added our daughter to our life, and I realized that my resources did not match the requirements from everything that I was doing. And
you know what, Ryan, it's so common. I mean, you know, and there's no shame in it. I think it's good to say, wow, I burnt out, and then go to your growth mindset. What did I learn from that? What actually can I do, and what shouldn't I be taking on anymore?
Yeah, I saw it as the biggest opportunity that my business has presented to me, in so much as reaching out for help and getting some really foundational help to grow and to change and to bring staff on. And I mean, in 3 to 4 months, we've completely changed how everything works, and and I'm feeling a lot better. And this, you know, when you talk about think win-win and getting mutual purpose, and is that the one that I'm thinking about? But no, beginning with the end in mind, like why do we jump on this podcast to begin with? One area that I feel is important to our industry is a recognition that we're in caring roles, and we spend our life caring about animals and that they're being treated well, and that their owners are happy. And I feel we forget sometimes to sharpen our saw and look after ourselves. To get even deeper, I mean, mental health issues and the extreme of that, suicide is a component of industries like the veterinary industry where people burn out. So the end in mind for me reaching out to you guys and making this podcast, well, it was to help people avoid that, because it's helped me. Reading Stephen's work has helped me over the years. One of the things that really helped me was number 3 you mentioned there, which was put first things first. An important part for me, and I find it interesting because it was so long ago that I read that book, and I've implemented what I learned from it since then. But I also have learned in my life that when periods of time have passed since I've read a text, I kind of have morphed them into my own application of, and then I go back and reread it. I'm like, oh, that's not what they were saying. But a big part of that for me was figuring out the difference between urgent and important. And that kind of changed my life. Can you unpack that a little bit more for the listeners of this show?
Absolutely. In fact, it's one of, I think, the things that people take away most from from the, you know, from the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, is this definition between urgent and important. I think we live in the most just urgent time. Everything's an urgency. Now, by that, I mean your phone rings, you get a text, you got an email notifier, you've got people coming to you constantly. And what that does is it puts us into a highly reactive mode. If you think about what's going on in our brain, we begin to act from our primitive brain. You hear a ding on your phone, you're almost like Pavlov's dogs, right? We start to, oh, there's a text, I need to respond. And so we can be highly conditioned to move into a very reactive way of doing things. And what we know is that highly effective people actually put limits into their lives so that they are not just reacting to every urgency and emergency. Now, we obviously have to react to urgent things that are important, but there's a lot of things that feel urgent, but they're not important. So something that's urgent and important is a crisis. But we're living a lot of our lives as if we are chronically in crisis. And it's because we have so much coming at us that what we end up doing is just reacting. In the field that I'm in, it's not unusual for someone to wake up in the morning, the first thing that they do is pick up their phone, they look at their phone, they scroll through the email that's come in overnight, any texts that have come in because we're in such a global 24/7 world. They then run out the door, you know, they go, you know, they quickly shower, they start working, and maybe they're working from home, they're on their computer almost first thing before they've even, you know, gotten dressed and gotten ready for the day, and they just start reacting to everything that's coming into them. And by the end of the day, they're exhausted. And have you ever had a day where it's just been go, 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 and at the end of the day, you've just not stopped, but you didn't get the most important thing done that you really needed to get done that day? That thing that was sitting out there that had to be done by 4 o'clock has not been done. And that's because we've gone for the low bar of just reacting to what's coming at us. When we're effective, Stephen coined the term big rocks. And he did this by, you know, doing this, you know, there's a visual where he's got somebody with a bowl, a glass bowl, and the bowl is half full of gravel. And then he has these big rocks that have things like work project and time with family and exercise and all the really big things in your life, you know, meet with a brand new client, do prospecting as a salesperson, whatever it is. And he has all those big rocks sitting on the side. And he says to the person, okay, you need to put everything in this bowl and fit it all in. And so the person's got a bowl that's already half full of gravel, and they get the big rocks and they start putting those in, but they can't fit them all in. And then he gives them another bowl and he says, you have a different way of doing this. You can start all over and think about how you can fit everything in. And so what the person does then is they start again and they put the big rocks in the bowl first. They pour the gravel over the top and it will all fit in. Now, nowadays we'd say don't even put all the gravel in. Half that gravel should not even go into the bowl. But it's the idea that at the beginning of every week, you need to have a master plan for your week. And you need to put the big rocks in first. And the big rocks are the things that you actually, they're things that matter most to you. It can be getting in some daily exercise, time with family, reading that professional journal that you keep saying that you're going to do, but you never get done. And you don't need to have a lot of them. I usually put in about 3 or 4 big rocks. I pick 1 or 2 things professionally that absolutely, it's the budget report that I keep putting off. It's the new hire that I know I have to spend some more time with, right? So 1 or 2 things professionally, because there's plenty of other stuff that will fly at me professionally. 1 or 2 things personally. There's a friend I haven't called in a long time. There's a family member that I know needs a little bit of extra TLC right now. I have a colleague that puts in 3 family dinners every week and she just does not let anything come in the way of that. So you put in your big rocks first and you put them into your phone. You put them into your Outlook. You put them into whatever calendaring system you have. And then you have the discipline in the moment to say, gosh, sorry, guys, I've got to leave early because I need to get home. Or, you know what, guys, I got to exercise tonight, so I'm going to have to call it quits right now. And it's the discipline of saying, these things are important enough. I'm going to get my big rocks done this week. When you habitually do that, you begin to have progress, you make achievements, you build deeper relationships, you learn that thing, you finish that qualification, and you don't let everything that's coming at you get in the way. Now, some people will say, well, I can't help it. I've got so much stuff going on. There's no way I could do that. Well, let's go back to habit one. Be proactive. You have a choice because everybody's got 24 hours in the day. If you do not carve out this time for yourself, nobody else will. And you will end up spending your life responding to everybody else's urgencies and emergencies. And you will never get your most important things done. Everybody will take your time. Only you can put those parameters in that say, these are my big rocks and I'm getting them done this week.
And I have done this for years. And kind of it comes and goes depending on where I am in my life. Like if I'm on holiday, obviously I'm kind of just thinking about lying on that beach.
Well, holidays, yeah. We're not saying for holidays, right? For holidays, I hope that you lay in and don't do anything.
Well, I find a lot of activities or practices like this in my life and from talking to other people kind of, they come in waves. You kind of do something and then life changes or shifts and you kind of drop it for a while. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you don't pick it up. This particular process of thinking about the big rocks and setting goals around them has been one for me that's personally kind of gone and then come back. But it's been consistent. Like it's my go-to strategy. It all changed last year, I think, when Summer was born and resources just meant that nothing was getting done. And so how do you, like, and maybe you've explained this, and maybe I just need you to re-say it in your words. How do you choose what's urgent and what's important? Like, how do you sit down and go, who am I? What's important to me? And what are my big rocks? Is there a process for that?
Boy, this is such a great question. So this is where habit two is, begin with the end in mind. This is where we have our mission statement builder. And that's why I'd say go onto our, Frank and Covey website. You can do it for free. It's really important to have a sense of who you are, what your values are, and what's most important to you. You cannot understand in your life what's urgent and what's important if you don't know what your life's all about. So just a couple of thoughts on this. I mean, I don't think, I've got to have a grand plan and it can never change. No, it's about being intentional. And sometimes, the birth of a new baby is going to throw everything into chaos. And it can be okay for a time and a season just to be, we are just trying to get by right now where, nobody's getting any sleep and all this stuff is going out the window for a few weeks. But pull it back in because once you start to establish normal, what you want is to put these good disciplines back into your life because they give you freedom. So, what we say to people is, look, there are times and seasons for everything. But don't go too long without these disciplines. I mean, gosh, when I go on holidays, I don't plan. I mean, I've got the things that I'm going to do, but it's really nice not to have to have a plan. But for probably 45 weeks of the year, I start every Sunday night. I sit down. What are my big rocks for the week? What are the two or three things that I absolutely need to get done this week in amidst everything else that's going on? And I'm not saying that people have to be superstars, but if you've got something in your heart that you know matters to you and you're not doing it, you will feel frustrated and disappointed. And this is what the seven habits are. Therefore, this is what effectiveness looks like. I have a system and a process for getting the most important things done, the things that truly matter to me. And that's why we talk about both family and, personal and professional. So what are the most important things for me professionally, but also what are the most important things for me personally? Which relationships are the most important ones? The highest predictor of our happiness in life is the strength of the relationships that we have with people that we love who love us. Now, it's also important to have animals in our lives because they love us unconditionally. We need to feel that love. And we also need to know how to foster that love with other people. So it's really important to carve out time for relationships. It's really important to carve out time for ourselves and to sharpen our saw. And it's very important to carve out time for growth and development, you know, professionally and in the things that we really care about. And that's what the seven habits allow you to do. They give you a framework for getting those most important things done and for identifying in your own life what's the difference between urgent and important.
And I said to wifey, I think it was maybe last night or night before, I said, oh, you know, now we've hired this person and she's starting to take over and we're starting to get some more free time, I'm going to bring back my goals. And she said, I really miss your goals. And that, and they were based on my roles, but I think I used to send them to her to have accountability, and I know that there was a bit, what can I do this week to become a better husband goal. So I think she's got some attachment to it. But this word roles, is this something that I've added, or is that something that Stephen talks about?
Look, it's definitely. So one of the things we do in Habit 3 is we ask people to think about what are their key roles and goals. So for most people, they've got two or three personal roles. So one might be a spouse or a partner. One might be as a parent or family member. You know, one of my roles is, you know, my mum's getting older and she's become, she's become a very important part of my life now because, she's very independent, but she also needs a little bit of extra care. We also have roles around our friendships, and you might have a role that is maybe you want to be a writer, maybe you want to be a podcaster. Maybe one of your roles is to work in a community group, to give something back. And so every week you say, these are the roles. This is who Catherine is. This is who Ryan is. Here are my three or four or five. We wouldn't say I probably have more than four or five because it's just too many. But here are my most important roles. And what are my goals for each of those roles this week? What's the one or two things that I'm going to do in that role this week to be effective? And what I loved about what you picked up is in that role, you know, particularly in the one where we're, you know, the role of a partner, a parent, a family member, a friend. One of the things, you know, that we tell people to ask is, what does that person actually need from you this week? What's the biggest deposit that you could make into their emotional bank account? And often we don't know unless we ask them. And I love that you'll go to your wife and say, you know, what can I do for you in this week, that will be the biggest help to you? What a deposit for her. And then the same thing for her to ask you that back as well. What's the most important thing I can do for you as your partner this week? And it's amazing sometimes the different things that we need from each other, because we tend to give based on what we think the person needs, and that's a reflection of us, but it may not be what they need at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes I would ask her, my specific question was, what can I do to be a better husband this week? And she would sometimes say, I don't know. Sometimes she'll say, I just need you to do the dishes every day, please. Like that is the biggest thing you can do for me. Sometimes she'll come up to me and said, hey, for your wifey goal next week, can you do this? Put up that shelf or just something.
And they're often little things, just to your point, Ryan. Like, could you just take the rubbish out this week so I don't have to do that? And those become little deposits that say, I love you and I care about you. And so if this is important to you, I'm going to do it. And those build deep emotional bank accounts between people. Because if you say, no, I'm not doing that, it says that what you need doesn't matter to me. And in our most important relationships, we will not have good relationships if what we need doesn't matter to that person and if what they need doesn't matter to us.
What about the role? Is this something that you include sometimes or you share with others, the role of just self-care, looking after yourself?
Mm-hmm. So the first role is sharpen the saw. So that's always the one that I do first every week. What are the things I'm going to do this week to sharpen the saw? And I have some pretty clear goals. Every day I have a 45-minute exercise, so I have a goal that I exercise for 45 minutes every day. So mentally, I read 10 pages from a book every day, because what so many of us are doing now is just scrolling through our phones. That's reactive. I'm just reading whatever's in front of me. It's not intentional. And many of us have really given up real learning because we're just so burnt out and tired. So I carve out some time every day. It only takes about 10 minutes. It's amazing what you can do. 10 pages a day. Then spiritually, I have a meditation practice that I do. It takes me 10 minutes a day. So those three things, so mentally, physically, and spiritually take up probably not quite an hour every day, but I space them out. So I exercise in the morning and I do my reading and my meditation at night. You've got to work out what's the right thing for you. And then emotionally, what's a deposit that I need in my emotional bank account? What's something that I'm going to do for somebody else? And that's usually just sort of during the week it's really thinking about. But it can be, you know, just connecting, you know, with another person, with a hug. It can be really taking care of somebody. But physically, spiritually, emotionally, and mentally, we start with those. How am I going to fill my own well this week before I go out and try and help other people? Because if you're burnt out, there's not a lot that you can give under those circumstances. And we all know what burnout feels like.
Thank you for that. I'm looking at the time. There's just one other aspect I wanted to ask you before we left. Number four is, I think, win-win. Mm-hmm. And you talked about the abundance mindset. And I just wanted to ask you to expand on that for our listeners, if that's okay.
Yeah. So, you know, when I'm not at my best self, my thinking is small. It's a little bit threatened. I'm uncomfortable with the success of others. And I see things as a competition. If you win, I lose. If you're big, I'm small. Or I don't value myself. I feel like, well, you know what? It doesn't matter what I think. Let everybody else have their way because I'm just so used to being walked all over. Right now, I'm using those as sort of cliches, but they're really true. We tend to operate when we're not at our best selves, either believing that everything's a competition or capitulating and believing that we don't have the right to ask for what we really want. And habit four, as I said, is called think win-win. It's not get win-win. We don't always get a win-win. You really need two people to create a real win-win, but boy, one person can do 90% of it. If you go into every encounter saying, hang on, time out for a second, I want to make sure that whatever happens feels really good to you and to me. And if you don't feel good about it, I don't want to do it. And if I don't feel good about it, I don't want us to go ahead. When you can create those ground rules and you have relationships with people that honor that spirit of win-win, of thinking win-win. So it's the mindset that precedes everything that we do. And it's the mindset of mutual benefit. You're valuable and I'm valuable. And sometimes I know for people that are very caring, they go into lose-win. It says, I care so much that your needs are more important than my needs. And that is a long-term recipe for failure. Highly effective people value the needs of others, but not at their expense. It is mutual benefit. Your needs are important and mine are too. So let's create some outcomes of mutual benefit here. Because what happens is we end up devaluing what matters most to us. We don't put our needs first. Then we end up feeling resentful. Then we end up feeling like we're a victim. We feel frustrated. We get burnt out. And then we wonder, but I care about all these people and I don't get anything back. And the problem's not out there. The problem's inside us. We have not required or set up situations of mutual benefit. Now, there are some people with whom we'll never get it. And that is true. But many times we can create win-win just by asking for it because we're working with a perfectly reasonable person.
Wonderful. Thank you. So just to recap quickly, habit one is be proactive. Number two is begin with the end in mind. Number three, mm-hmm. put first things first. Number four, mm-hmm. we're just talking about it, think win-win. Number five, I love it, seek first to understand and then to be understood. Yes. Number six, synergize. Mm-hmm. And number seven, sharpen the saw.
That's right. And if you go to franklincovey.com, you'll see the seven habits on the website there. And they're very clearly, I mean, there's no secret about them. You're welcome to have a look at it. I'm sure there's something there that you can download too that will give you a little bit more information about them.
Awesome. And learn what Stephen Covey looks like and make sure that it's actually him on the back.
That it's not Yul Brynner on the back of the book. No, that's right. Look, there was a 30th anniversary edition that came out about a year ago. And his son, Sean Covey, who used to be my boss for about 5 or 6 years and is a good friend of mine, he wrote the foreword and he also put a new ending on every chapter that kind of gave some new insights and thoughts. Stephen passed away in 2012, so now His sons are sort of out there with his message. But this is what I have done for a lot of years too, is teach these habits to people. And look, I am a grateful, recovering, ineffective person. I wasn't born knowing these things. I am learning every day, and I still screw up, and I still have to go back and say, okay, oh, man, I did not get that one right. Here, let me go back and see if I can fix it. But at least now you have a language and a framework for understanding what effective behavior looks like.
So you're still humans that work at Franklin?
Yeah, just barely, yes. Yes, I'm very human.
Wonderful.
Very flawed.
Me too. And on that note, we will be wrapping up now. We will, of course, link to everything that we've mentioned today in the show notes, and you can do the Google search, as Catherine shared with us. This has been a ton of fun. So from myself and on behalf of everyone who listens to our show, we really appreciate you, Catherine, taking the time to come and hang out with us animal trainers today. Thank you so much.
Absolutely my pleasure, Ryan. Thank you.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much everyone for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.